Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanka and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Green and Red podcast. I'm co-host Scott Parkin. During a recent private fundraiser, President Joe Biden was speaking about the threats posed by Vladimir Putin to Ukraine and all of Europe and said, for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have a direct threat to the use of nuclear weapons. If in fact things continue down the path they'd be going. He also said, we have not faced the prospect of Armageddon since Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's a great starting point, since today on Green and Red, we're going to commemorate the 60th anniversary of that event, which took place in the latter half of October 1962, an entire show about arguably the most grave crisis in the nuclear era, when the deployment of Soviet missiles in Cuba and President John Kennedy's response, which has been highly praised for six decades now, actually brought the two countries close to a nuclear exchange. The incident is already well known and has been written about extensively. What we want to do today is give you a brief description of the crisis, and then more importantly, discuss President Kennedy's role in exacerbating and intensifying the danger, and also discuss the aftermath of the crisis. Today on Green and Red, the missiles of October, 60 years ago this month, remembering and reinterpreting.
Thanks, Scott. Hi, I'm co-host Bob Bazanko, and I'm excited to be talking about one of these pivotal events in not just Cold War history, but in modern history. John Kennedy has been universally praised for his handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, perhaps the person most responsible, somebody we've talked about before, filmmaker Oliver Stone, who said it was the greatest single act of human courage this world has ever witnessed with that much at stake. Now, that's not just Hollywood rhetoric. If you do a basic study of the event, most commentators offer high praise for JFK for, in their versions, firmly standing up to the Soviets and simultaneously preventing a nuclear war. But there's so much more to the missile crisis than that. And today we want to commemorate it, but with a different narrative. We'll talk about the actual crisis, of course, the so-called 13 days. But even more, we want to discuss the background to the showdown of October 1962, and just as importantly, the aftermath. Much of Kennedy's public legacy, polished by people like Stone and a cadre of JFK admirers who write books and give talks and produce movies about him, is based on the idea that he was a man of peace, he was someone who was moving towards some kind of a detente with the Soviet Union and a thaw with Cuba, and that the missile crisis was almost a road to Damascus experience for him, not provocative saber rattling against a much smaller and weaker country, which he'd been trying to overthrow since he became president. So first, some background. As Kennedy was inaugurated in January of 1961, he faced a dilemma in Cuba, where the 1959 revolution had put Fidel Castro into power. In fact, in his debates with Richard Nixon, JFK attacked the Republicans for allowing the establishment of a communist country so close to the United States. Since 1898, Cuba had been virtually an American economic colony with significant U.S. investment. Americans owned 80% of Cuba's utilities, 90% of its mining, 40% of its sugar, had a base in Guantanamo, had casinos where tourists could go for entertainment and gambling, which was an environment accurately described in The Godfather Part II. The U.S. ambassador to Cuba, Earl Smith, said in 1960, the American ambassador was the second most important man in Cuba, sometimes even more important than the president. Castro, after he took over, immediately took measures to distance himself from that U.S. control. He instituted land reform that took property away from U.S. corporations to give the Cuban peasants. He condemned the Platt Amendment, insisted on the return of Gitmo, took on the gangsters in the casinos, and sought actual Cuban independence from the Americans. In 1960, Castro infuriated the U.S. by agreeing to a deal to trade sugar with the Soviet Union in exchange for oil, machinery, and technicians. Trade between Castro and the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe soared from 2% to 80% that year. Castro's relationship with the Soviets would cause concern and alarm within the U.S. and later be seen as a cause for military action. But even the U.S. ambassador, Philip Bonsall, later admitted Russia came to Castro's rescue only after the United States had taken steps to overthrow him. In April 1961, not even 100 days into his presidency, JFK, of course, authorized an invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, an inlet on the southern coast across from Havana. Castro had vowed what happened in Guatemala, the overthrow of Arbenz in 1954, will not happen here. So when about 1,500 CIA-trained Miami Cubans arrived at the Bay of Pigs on April 17, 1961, Castro himself led the battle on the beaches, and they crushed the American-backed invasion in 2 days with 114 dead and 1,100 captured, an utter disaster. In turn, Kennedy tightened the noose on Cuba even more with an economic blockade that still exists today, removal of the country from the OAS, and sponsorship of countless assassination attempts against Castro for many years, all of which, of course, failed. The U.S. also began Operation Mongoose, which hoped to ignite a revolt against Castro inside Cuba. And in fact, the U.S. had been organizing Cubans who had fled and moved to Miami to go back and conduct subversion to overthrow Castro. And they had been conducting military maneuvers off the Cuban coast. The Cuban government believed that the U.S. was all in on doing whatever it would take to overthrow them, logically. And even the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, later admitted, if I had been in Moscow or Havana at that time, I would have believed the Americans were preparing for an invasion. Logically, then, the Cubans saw Soviet support and eventually missiles as an important way to stop the U.S. from attacking. But in reality, and this is a crucial point, any aid from Moscow could not change the balance of power in North America at all. The U.S. had a 20,000 to 1,600 advantage in nuclear weapons. Yet Kennedy always responded aggressively to any sign of Russian support to Havana, and never more so when he brought the world to the brink of nuclear war in 1962. Against that backdrop, with the U.S. committed to getting rid of Castro and the Soviet Union on board as a Cuban ally, after early 1961, the events of 1962 unfolded.
You're listening to the Green and Red podcast. We're talking about the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. If you want to support us or check out more about us, go to greenandredpodcast.org. Most discussions of the missile crisis begin with the mid-October discovery of Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba, but the entire episode began earlier. In the spring of 1962, Soviet officials worked out details of an operation with Castro to deploy R-12 missiles, named differently by the U.S., with a range of about 1,200 miles, which meant they could hit as far north as New York City from Cuba. From July into October, the Soviets began to secretly send troops and weapons to Castro, eventually deploying 36 R-12 missiles and 24 launchers, along with tactical cruise missiles. In August, the U.S. began to notice something happening in Cuba as U-2 spy planes took photographs of Soviet anti-aircraft sites in Cuba, and CIA Director John McCone speculated that Russian military officials were trying to hide a ballistic missile deployment to Havana. At the same time, Republican Senator Kenneth Keating of New York publicly accused JFK of allowing a Soviet buildup in Cuba that included nuclear weapons. He didn't know it at the time, but he was guessing right. The first Soviet missiles weren't in Cuba yet, but Keating's public words forced JFK to warn the Kremlin that the Soviet missiles in Cuba would raise the gravest of issues, quote unquote. At the same time, JFK and the National Security Council were finalizing NSA Memorandum 181, which laid out planning for an American response to Soviet missiles in Cuba. Even though the U.S. did not know that nuclear weapons were going to be deployed there, policymakers concluded, in sum, the expectation is that any missiles will have a substantial political and psychological impact, while surface-to-surface missiles would create a condition of great alarm, even in the absence of proof that nuclear warheads were arriving with them, quote unquote. It also directed military officials to plan to provoke more internal subversion in Cuba, which could be followed by U.S. military intervention. About a month later, during an October 1 meeting between McNamara and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, McNamara discussed possible military action and blockade against Cuba and told the chiefs, especially the Navy, to be prepared to establish a blockade of Cuba. Then, on October 4th, 1962, the first Soviet missiles arrived in Cuba at the port of Mariel under the command of Soviet Colonel Nikolai Beloborodov. The Soviets saw the missiles as a way to preserve Cuban sovereignty amid the constant American assaults on Cuba since Castro had taken over. Beloborodov later wrote, "It was clear that in the conditions of the existing balance of forces and conventional arms, which was 10 to 1 against them, there was only one way we could repel a massive assault, by using tactical nuclear weapons against the invaders. In principle, this action would be consistent with international law on the protection of sovereignty and freedom, but that would be the beginning of the end. Only madmen could unleash a nuclear war." These initial actions by the US and the Soviet Union were part of a much longer period of tensions between the two sides. As we've seen, and just as JFK had been laying out the groundwork to eliminate Castro's regime, the Soviets had been preparing to defend it. In fact, the Cubans and the Russians later called the events of late 1962 the October Crisis, because the U.S. covert war, which had ramped up with Mongoose, produced monthly crises for the Cubans. And throughout the buildup to October, the purposes of both sides was clear. For the U.S., it was getting rid of Castro, and for the Soviets, it was defending Cuba. By mid-October, the U.S. had been receiving reports from its operatives that the Soviets were bringing weapons into Cuba. They were not specific regarding nuclear missiles. On October 9th, 1962, Kennedy approved U-2 reconnaissance flights over Cuba to verify reports that the Soviets were deploying missiles in an area of concern in western Cuba. Because of bad weather, the first U-2 flights weren't deployed until October 14th. October 14th is the date you usually see associated with the unofficial beginning of the crisis. On that date, U-2 pilots took the first U.S. intelligence photographs of Soviet medium-range ballistic missiles in Cuba. The U-2 photos revealed medium-range missiles codenamed SS-4 and SS-5 by NATO. This is also what we have been referring to as the Soviet R-12s, and also ballistic missile facilities. Years later, Nikita Khrushchev's son, Sergei, said that his father had sent missiles as a diplomatic signal, as his son said, "Don't invade Cuba, we're serious."
A couple days after that, on the 16th, Kennedy had the first meeting to discuss the missiles in Cuba with an advisory group that would become famously known as the XCOM, the Executive Committee. The options laid out that day were to negotiate with Khrushchev and Castro to quarantine, blockade Cuba with the Navy, and to conduct airstrikes to destroy missile sites, which might provoke a Soviet response elsewhere, maybe even in Berlin. Kennedy's first instincts were to go with the quarantine and to call it a quarantine, since a blockade can be considered an act of war, and he officially decided on that a few days later. At that meeting on October the 16th, Kennedy also apparently had some regrets about his August statement that the Soviet missiles would raise the gravest issues because of the intensity of the new danger. And according to others at the meeting, the president kind of joked, we weren't going to accept offensive missiles in Cuba. And last month I should have said, well, we just don't care. During that meeting, there was also a fascinating exchange between Kennedy and some of his aides that precisely showed that the Soviet missiles in Cuba were not the threat the U.S. would claim they were. And I'm going to read just a little bit of the transcript of that meeting. Kennedy starts by saying, "Why does he put these in there, though?" Meaning the Khrushchev and the missiles. McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, said, "Soviet-controlled nuclear warheads of that kind?" JFK said, "That's right, but what's the advantage of that? It's just as if we suddenly began to put a major number of MRBMs in Turkey. Now that'd be goddamn dangerous, I would think." And Bundy says, "Well, we did, Mr. President." And you, Alexis Johnson, who was the Deputy Undersecretary for Political Affairs, said, "We did it. Kennedy said, "Yeah, but that was 5 years ago." And you, Alexis Johnson, said, "We did it in England, and that's why we were short." Kennedy says, "What?" Johnson says, "We gave England 2-1. We were short of ICBMs." "Yeah, but that's," Kennedy said. Johnson said, "Testing?" And Kennedy finished, "That was different during a different period then." So it's pretty clear at the very moment that Kennedy and the XCOM were planning to ramp up these tensions and potentially provoke a military exchange, maybe nuclear, between the U.S. and Soviet Union, the president knew that America's own military posture was stronger, that the Soviets were living with medium-range ballistic missiles in Turkey right across the Black Sea from the USSR. And that mention of the weapons in Turkey would become really critical later. Kennedy also introduced what would be one of the key factors going forward, and this was also true of Vietnam, American credibility. He said, but when we said we're not going to, and then they go ahead and do it, and then we do nothing, then I would think that our risks increase. Passively accepting the missiles at any point would likely have been untenable politically to JFK. And the president said, they've got enough to blow us up now anyway. After all, this is a political struggle as much as military. So to be clear, from the very outset, Kennedy had a clear understanding that the missiles in Cuba had not changed the balance of power and did not provide a justifiable reason to risk nuclear war. In 1962, the U.S. had about 160 ICBM and 2,500 strategic bombers, while the Soviets had 24 ICBM, along with the aforementioned 20,000 to 1,600 nuclear weapon domination. Moscow knew that it was far behind the U.S. and in no position to confront Washington militarily, and Kennedy knew that as well. They both knew what each other knew. But he also knew that the issue was political, that in his mind, the imperatives of the Cold War demanded a strong American response and flexing of U.S. military might, even if it was provocative and could lead to the gravest consequences. Decades later, Khrushchev's son, Sergei, who Scott just quoted, half seriously said that the U.S. should have just let the rocket sit out there in Cuba in the heat because the steel would have rusted, the propellant dissipated, the warheads would have been using up all the ice produced in Cuba to keep from overheating. And within months, no more than a year, the rockets wouldn't fire. The Soviets never understood why Kennedy created such a crisis. That meeting of October 16th began the famous 13 days of the missile crisis, the subject of a huge number of articles, books, documentaries, and movies.
The 13 days of crisis, which isn't really accurate because the crisis, as we've seen, preceded the discovery of the Soviet missiles and continued into November, were filled with some of the more anxious moments in post-war U.S. history. Rather than offer a detailed daily account of what happened, we're going to focus on a few really key elements to the crisis. First, JFK's announcement to the public about the discovery of the missiles in Cuba. Second, JFK's aggressive military deployment and the U.S. quarantine and confrontations at sea against Soviet vessels. Third, efforts at negotiations and Nikita Khrushchev's letters to Kennedy, eventually leading to a deal involving missiles in Cuba and Turkey. After all that, we'll talk about the aftermath, consequences, and historical memory of the events of October. First, Kennedy told the Americans about the missiles in Cuba on October 22nd, and it terrified the country. It was the first nuclear crisis after 17 years of constant panic and fear-mongering about atomic war, creation of the national security state, civilian preparedness, duck and cover propaganda for every kid in America. It shook the country unlike anything had in the modern era. Kennedy revealed the presence of the weapons in Cuba, announced the quarantine, and during the speech sent orders to all U.S. forces worldwide, placing them on defense readiness condition, also known as DEFCON 3, which meant that the Air Force had to be ready to mobilize within 15 minutes. We're going to play a couple of clips from JFK's October 22nd speech. First, his opening, where he laid out the crisis and pushed responsibility for it onto the USSR in Cuba, charging that Moscow had interfered in Cuba's special and historical relationship to the United States, meaning the Monroe Doctrine.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere, ranging as far north as Hudson's Bay, Canada, and as far south as Lima, Peru. In addition, jet bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons are now being uncrated and assembled in Cuba, while the necessary air bases are being prepared. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas in flagrant and deliberate defiance of the Rio Pact of 1947, the traditions of this nation and hemisphere, the joint resolution of the 87th Congress, the Charter of the United Nations, and my own public warnings to the Soviets on September 4th and 13th. This action also contradicts the repeated assurances of Soviet spokesmen, both publicly and privately delivered, that the arms buildup in Cuba would retain its original defensive character, and that the Soviet Union had no need or desire to station strategic missiles on the territory of any other nation.
And then here, Kennedy then described in more detail the U.S. version of the crisis, its origins and its gravity. And then he laid out a list of his responses to the placement of missiles in Cuba.
The 1930s taught us a clear lesson. Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war. This nation is opposed to war. We are also true to our word. Our unswerving objective, therefore, must be to prevent the use of these missiles against this or any other country, and to secure their withdrawal or elimination from the Western Hemisphere. Our policy has been one of patience and restraint, as befits a peaceful and powerful nation which leads a worldwide alliance. We have been determined not to be diverted from our central concerns by mere irritants and fanatics. But now further action is required, and it is underway, and these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. The foreign ministers of the OAS, in their communique of October 6, rejected secrecy on such matters in this hemisphere. should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities, and I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. Fourth, as a necessary military precaution, I have reinforced our base at Guantanamo, evacuated today the dependents of our personnel there, and ordered additional military units to be on a standby alert basis. Fifth, we are calling tonight for an immediate meeting of the Organization of Consultation under the Organization of American States to consider this threat to hemispheric security and to invoke Article 6 and 8 of the Rio Treaty in support of all necessary action. The United Nations Charter allows for regional security arrangements, and the nations of this hemisphere decided long ago against the military presence of outside powers. Our other allies around the world have also been alerted. Sixth, under the Charter of the United Nations, we are asking tonight that an emergency meeting of the Security Council be convoked without delay to take action against this latest Soviet threat to world peace. Our resolution will call for the prompt dismantling and withdrawal of all offensive weapons in Cuba under the supervision of UN observers before the quarantine can be lifted. Seventh and finally, I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. He has an opportunity now to move the world back from the abyss of destruction by returning to his government's own words that it had no need to station missiles outside its own territory, and withdrawing these weapons from Cuba by refraining from any action which will widen or deepen the present crisis, and then by participating in a search for peaceful and permanent solutions.
The most aggressive part of the response was obviously the quarantine that led to near disaster in coming days. As Americans were proceeding, the shocking news that JFK had delivered the crisis continued with American quarantine in place and Soviet ships heading toward Cuba. On the 25th, two U.S. ships, the USS Essex and the Gearing, attempted to intercept a Soviet tanker, the Bucharest, 500 miles at sea from the Cuban coast, but failed to do so, and ultimately decided to let it through the blockade after determining it did not contain military material. Intercepted military cables indicated that several Russian ships bound for Cuba were altering their course away from the quarantine line. Wary of confronting U.S. forces in the waters, while JFK was aggressive, the Soviets remained ever cautious, aware of their significant weakness compared to the Americans. Kennedy, however, raised the stakes on the 25th, requesting an emergency meeting of the UN to challenge the Soviet ambassador about the missiles. And then the next day, he raised the readiness level to DEFCON 2, the last step before nuclear weapons would be used, in which all armed forces were required to be ready to deploy and fight within 6 hours. And the only confirmed use of that level in U.S. history. B-52 bombers were on continuous airborne alert, and other medium bombers were sent to various airfields and prepared to take off on 15 minutes notice. About 180 of the Strategic Air Command's bombers were put on alert, and almost 150 ICBMs were on ready alert. Hey folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast, where we interview guests like Noam Chomsky and Andrew Bacevich, We also have shows on cultural icons like Johnny Cash and Woody Guthrie and the Godfather movies. And we talk to scores of organizers and activists who tell us what is happening in the streets and in the back country. So check us out.
Yeah, and I'm Bob Bezanko. And as always, Scott and I want to thank you for listening, for watching, for supporting us. And we hope we continue to do that. The first thing we ask is that you share this. Let people know that we're out there and we're doing something that I think is different. We have a good niche, I think, in Left Podcast. And we talk to really cool people and about really important issues. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Go to our webpage, which is on in the screen. And, you know, if you really like us and if you have a little extra change around, jingles or folds, you can help us out by
going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button and make a one-time donation. Or you can check us out at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast and become a patron. We'll see you again real soon.
More ominously, 23 nuclear armed B-52s were sent to points within striking distance of the Soviet Union. The Soviets, however, were standing down, and the U.S. knew it. Air Force General and Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans and Operations David Birchenhall later recalled and admitted, while JFK had put in a sea blockade and had 80% of SAC's Premier Command fleet prepared to strike Cuba or the Soviet Union, the Russians, as Birchenhall said, didn't make any move. They didn't do a thing. They froze in place. We were never further from nuclear war than at that time in Cuba. Despite the one-sided war mobilization, and just 2 days after the Essex and Gary challenged the Bucharest, the most dire confrontation of the entire crisis occurred. October 27th was the most dangerous day in post-war history. In the post-war era, up to September 11, 2001, an American U-2 accidentally flew into Soviet airspace, and even more dangerously, another U-2 was shot down over Cuba, killing an American pilot and bringing Kennedy to the brink of a strong military retaliation. The death of the pilot, Rudolf Anderson, led the military chiefs to call for massive retaliation, even an invasion of Cuba, leading the Army Chief of Staff Earl Wheeler to worry that Khrushchev may let loose one of his missiles on us. Later, the JCS chair, Maxwell Taylor, briefed the other officers about the White House meeting. Taylor was on the ex-con that had been held earlier that day, and he told them that Kennedy was considering a swap of removing missiles in Turkey if Khrushchev did so in Cuba because, Maxwell Taylor said, the president has a feeling that time is running out. As the White House and the chiefs were debating the response to the U-2 shoot down, and unknown to the JCS at the time, the American destroyer Beale, which was in international waters, and that's a key point in all of these confrontations take place in international waters. The Beale confronted a Soviet B-59 submarine, and it dropped depth charges to force it to surface. The Soviet crew believed that a war had broken out, and a Soviet intelligence officer on the sub, Vadim Orlov, later described how the U.S. ships, as in his words, surrounded us and started to tighten the circle, practicing attacks and dropping depth charges. They exploded right next to the hull. It felt like you were sitting in a metal barrel while somebody is constantly blasting with a sledgehammer. The B-59 was carrying a nuclear-tipped torpedo, which American naval forces did not know. And it had about two-thirds the blast capacity of the bombings at Hiroshima. Its nearest target would have been an anti-sub aircraft carrier, the Randolph, which had a crew of 3,400 sailors and Marines on it that day. And that's more than the number of Americans killed at Pearl Harbor or on 9/11. The Soviet sub was prepared to fire back, but the three senior officers on board had to agree unanimously to agree to launch immediately. Vasily Arkhipov did not, and may very well have prevented the war. Arkhipov wasn't sure that they were under attack and wanted the sub to surface and await orders from Moscow. In addition, the B-59's batteries were low and its air conditioning was failing. It was built for the Arctic, not the warm Sargasso Sea. So the sub surfaced and began its return trip to the USSR, ultimately without incident. At the very moment Kennedy had filled the skies with nuclear armed planes and had gone to DEFCON 2, the Soviet sub officer had the composure to deflate the crisis at sea and perhaps save the world from nuclear war. That didn't, however, mean that the danger had passed. SAC officers at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana had rigged the launch system on a Minuteman ICBM to give themselves independent launch authority and bypass normal procedures. They basically decided they weren't going to listen to the Pentagon. A tactical missile squadron on Okinawa also received erroneous launch orders for the nuclear cruise missiles, but an Air Force captain fortunately questioned the order since DEFCON 1 was not in effect. In fact, three of the targets in the top secret envelope, which is like the one that Major King Kong opened in Dr. Strangelove, were in China, which had nothing to do with the crisis. Inside Cuba, the Soviet missiles were put on launchers that day and were operational. While the Soviet-American confrontation at sea was developing, the crisis was moving toward its conclusion, however, as representatives from the U.S. and USSR began to talk to each other and carve out a settlement, which is the third key element that we want to talk about.
You're listening to the Green and Red podcast, and we're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis at 60. If you want to support us or learn more, check us out at greenandredpodcast.org. JFK had made contact immediately with the Soviets as soon as the missiles were photographed, instructing his brother and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy to contact the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin to express American concern, and was told by Dobrynin that there would be no ground-to-ground missiles or offensive weapons put into Cuba, and that the USSR wouldn't disrupt Soviet-American relationships. A couple of days later, on the 18th, JFK met with Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko, who reiterated that the weapons were for defensive purposes, to prevent an American attack to oust Castro. Kennedy did not tell Gromyko that the U.S. had the U-2 photos of the sites and were aware of the specifics of the missile buildup. And since then, supporters of JFK have cited this to show that Gromyko and the Russians were being duplicitous. But the Russian insistence that the missiles were defensive and that they were given an ally reassurance amid constant American threats to overthrow has generally been discounted. Though the Soviets were consistent on that point and didn't intend to use the missiles to attack the U.S. unless some kind of move was made against the government in Havana. While missiles can surely have offensive and defensive purposes, or both, the Soviets had been steadfast in their intention to protect Cuba and not provoke a war with America. After Kennedy's public speech, the sense of alarm had grown dramatically. On October 24th, Khrushchev sent a telegram to JFK calling the blockade an act of aggression, an outright piracy that would lead to war, and said the USSR had to decline the despotic demands of the U.S., quote unquote. Kennedy responded the next day by telling the Soviet leader that the U.S. had been forced to respond that way because he had denied that there were offensive weapons in Cuba, and that he hoped, quote, your government will take necessary action to permit a restoration of the earlier situation, end quote. The president also decided to confront the Soviets publicly with UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson challenging the Russian representative over the missiles on October 25th. Stevenson demanded a Soviet response to the U.S. allegations that had placed offensive missiles in Cuba and told the assembly that he was prepared to wait till hell freezes over for the Russians to admit to putting the weapon in a country so close to the U.S. And of course, this was all happening at the same time as American and Soviet ships were contesting each other at sea. The situation was close to warfare. As conditions in Washington, Moscow, and Havana seemed to be spinning out of control, Khrushchev sent another letter to Kennedy the next day, the 26th, telling the president that he would remove the missiles from Cuba if the U.S. guaranteed it would not invade Cuba. At the same time, Bobby Kennedy met with Dobrynin and told him that the U.S. would be willing to discuss removing American Jupiter missiles from Turkey as part of a negotiated deal. Even as both sides seemed to be looking for a way out of the crisis, the B-59 incident occurred and the U.S. staged a hydrogen bomb test with a B-52 dropping a 800-kiloton bomb over the Pacific. The pace of events was speeding up, and Khrushchev at the time also proposed that he would remove the missiles that if JFK promised not to invade Cuba and remove its missiles from Turkey. On the 27th, he wrote, "You are disturbed over Cuba. You say that this disturbs you because it is 99 miles by sea from the coast of the United States of America. But you have placed destructive missiles, which you call offensive, in Italy and Turkey, literally next to us. I therefore make this proposal. We are willing to remove from Cuba the means which you regard as offensive. Your representatives will make a declaration to the effect that the United States will remove its analogous means from Turkey. And after that, persons entrusted by the United Nations Security Council could inspect on the spot the fulfillment of the pledges made." The Jupiter missiles in Turkey added another element to the crisis. The Jupiters were outdated and being phased out anyway, to be replaced by Polaris missiles. So Khrushchev's proposal was reasonable and offered a clear way out of the crisis. Kennedy himself realized the U.S. would be in an unsupportable position if Khrushchev's proposal became public because the Jupiters were obsolete, and the president said, quote, to any many at the United Nations or any other rational man, it will look like a very fair trade, end quote. It wasn't a fair trade. Soviet leader had created a simple plan, just two options. The U.S. would promise not to invade Cuba, and it would remove Jupiter missiles from Turkey. Kennedy didn't want to do the deal, didn't like either option, even though the U.S. would be giving up nothing substantial in the process, disagreeing not to do something and giving up something that it was going to scrap anyway. But as National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy told JFK, the U.S. could not acquiesce to Khrushchev's plan. Quote, "The current threat to peace is not in Turkey, it is in Cuba," end quote, he said. Obviously, the U.S. had a vastly superior nuclear arsenal trained on Moscow itself, not to even mention the overwhelming dominance the U.S. had over Cuba. It could have obliterated the island in an instant, but that wasn't the point. Demonstrating power and will, even at the risk of nuclear war, was the point.
This is Scott and Bob on the Green and Red podcast talking about the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis with a new interpretation of it, especially focused on JFK. We always appreciate your support, so be sure to share and subscribe. The events we mentioned earlier on the 27th, the U-2 shoot down, the confrontation between the Beagle and the B-59 sub, the general itching for war that forced the White House to take negotiations more seriously. Bobby Kennedy, as Scott said, was meeting with Dobrynin at the Department of Justice and warned him that the U.S. was prepared to bomb the Soviet sites in Cuba, but he also offered the potential carrot of a trade of the Jupiters for the SS-4 missiles, a quid pro quo. "Time is of the essence, and we shouldn't miss the chance," Bobby Kennedy told the Soviet ambassador, but even then, JFK moved slowly. Faced with a chance to pull back from the brink on October 27th, Kennedy didn't want the world to think he had made concessions on the Jupiters, which would be a sign of weakness as he saw it. But Khrushchev took the initiative and took action the next day to end the crisis. In a speech on Radio Moscow, the Soviet leader announced that the missiles in Cuba were being dismantled, and he did not demand that the Jupiters be removed. Silently, the U.S. had agreed to take the Jupiters out, but they didn't want the world to know that they'd made a deal. Kennedy was aggressive to the bitter end. As McNamara later said, "We were eyeball to eyeball and the other guy blinked." But we now know, based on recently released documents from the National Security Archive, and if any of you are interested in that, that would be the starting point. They're just, it's a magisterial place, and pretty much everything we're saying today is based on documents that we found on the National Security Archives collection. So today, recently, I think actually like today, that new documents have been released, and we find that Kennedy was in fact so concerned with these ideas of credibility and publicly appearing to stare down Khrushchev that he and his aides created a cover-up of sorts and refused to admit that there had been a quid pro quo, the SS-4 for the Jupiters, to end the crisis. They made sure that the media and others writing the story of the missile crisis credited JFK's strength and resolve as the key factor in forcing the Soviets to blink. They even went so far as to smear Adlai Stevenson, the UN ambassador who confronted the Russians at the UN, but who also urged Kennedy to accept Khrushchev's deal by planting stories in the press about him with an unadmiring official quoted as saying, "Adlai wanted a Munich. He wanted to trade U.S. bases for Cuban bases." the unadmiring official, it was John F. Kennedy. Indeed, the president had added that line to a draft of the article in his own handwriting. So, although the immediate crisis of October 1962 had subsided and Kennedy had come across like a hero, the residue of the near confrontation between nuclear armed forces and the legacy of Kennedy's conflict during the crisis continued to have important meaning. The phrase, the Cuban Missile Crisis, has now become shorthand for global conflicts of severe gravity, and it's invoked to stress how important the stakes are. It's been used many times, the Six-Day War, the Iranian hostage crisis, Reagan's wars in Central America, the Gulf War, various Middle Eastern crises, and of course, 9/11, and as Biden just did. At the same time, the general view of Kennedy has been overwhelmingly positive, and he's held up as an example of strength and courage and resolve in the face of great danger. In fact, in a special CBS News report on the night of October 28, 1962, the well-regarded journalist Charles Collingwood set the tone for the way Kennedy would be viewed, saying that the world had come, quote, from under the most terrible threat of nuclear holocaust since World War II, with a humiliating defeat for Soviet policy. But like we've seen, you know, repeatedly, many of Kennedy's decisions were reckless. The U.S. had an overwhelming advantage in the balance of power against Cuba and Moscow, and that has to be stressed pretty strongly. Of course, the presence of nuclear weapons in a country close to the U.S. would raise concern and call for action. But the possibility of these weapons being used offensively against America prior to Kennedy's blustering was minimal, if not zero. Any nuclear attack would have led to the immediate annihilation of Cuba and immense attacks against the Soviet Union itself. Kennedy knew this, but his credibility and his need to assert global power was more important. He was willing to risk nuclear war in order to maintain U.S. hegemony and empire. But thanks to Oliver Stone and a cadre of scholars and journalists and politicians, Kennedy's actions are still seen as heroic, and the Cuban Missile Crisis is cited as his shining moment when he not only stood up to the gravest challenges, but learned from it and became a global force for peace afterward. But that too isn't the case. We want to talk a little about the post-missile crisis Kennedy, the president who still prays for his handling of the crisis. The reality, however, is that JFK after October 1962 wasn't much different than JFK before October 1962. When you peel away the layers of the rhetoric and the spectacle of the global crisis, Kennedy and American actions globally were the same. After the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, Kennedy believed that success in Vietnam could mitigate the public fallout from the disasters in Cuba. And from that point on, the fortune of those third world revolutions were always linked. Kennedy never got any lessons from the crisis in Cuba that led him to take anything but a militarist and interventionist approach in Vietnam. And after the missile crisis, the U.S. ramped up its commitment to Vietnam. There was no transition to peacemaker. Yet, one of the key claims by establishment fans of Kennedy is that the Cuban Missile Crisis shook Kennedy so much that he was on the path to normalizing relations with Cuba itself. But once again, the record, the archives, the documents all tell a different story. The American-sponsored subversion inside Cuba continued during the missile crisis, during October 1962. The subversion had not ended. In fact, on November 8th, as the Pentagon acknowledged that the Soviet missiles in Cuba had been dismantled, a CIA unit dispatched from Miami blew up a Cuban industrial facility and killed 400 workers. Not even 2 weeks after pledging to Khrushchev that the U.S. would not try to overthrow Castro's government.
On November 16th, the U.S. began an exercise to simulate a full-scale invasion of Cuba at Onslow Beach, North Carolina, which included 6 Marine Battalion landing teams and overall had 100,000 Army troops, 40,000 Marines, and about 15,000 paratroopers ready to fight in Cuba, as well as 550 combat aircraft and over 180 ships available to support an invasion. A few days after that, the U.S. representatives met with their Soviet counterparts to finally resolve the issue of 42 Russian aircraft that remained in Cuba, with the U.S. aggressively demanding their immediate removal. JFK also renewed high-altitude incursions of Cuban airspace to gather intelligence, though low-altitude flights were suspended. At the meeting, Bobby Kennedy wrote on an envelope, "President reluctant to send in low-level flights. How far can we push Khrushchev?" And then he threatened Soviet diplomats that the low-level warplanes would begin flying over Cuba again unless all the Russian planes were removed. All the while, the entire U.S. North American arsenal could be deployed against Havana with 550 combat aircraft on alert to attack Cuba on short notice. Kennedy, the so-called peacemaker, had not taken his foot off the gas and still posed an existential threat to Castro's government. In December, JFK ended the year in Miami playing a public tribute to the Cuban Invasion Brigade, pledging that Cuba would be made free with the Alliance for Progress and American help. In an April 1963 meeting, JFK made it clear that he had not given up on removing Castro, but insisted it had to be a Miami-Cuban effort and wondered whether active sabotage was good unless it was of a type that could only come from within Cuba. In mid-1963, Bromley Smith, the executive secretary of the National Security Council, presented an analysis that made it clear that Kennedy had decided to end the restraint he had shown on Cuba and was committing American assets to the campaign against Castro with harassment, sabotage, and economic damage. And as we know, assassination attempts against Fidel continued. And on Castro's end, despite claims by Oliver Stone and others like journalist Peter Kornbluh that the Cuban leader was warming up to JFK, he continued to be as wary as possible about the U.S. president. At a reception at the Brazilian embassy in Havana on September 7th, Castro held a spontaneous interview with an AP reporter where he called JFK a cretin, the Batista of his times, and the most opportunistic president of all time. He also denounced the continuing American-sponsored raids on Cuban territory and said, "We are prepared to fight them and answer in kind. U.S. leaders should think if they are aiding terrorist plans to eliminate Cuban leaders. They themselves will not be safe." Early in November, not 2 weeks before his death, JFK ramped up terrorist operations in Cuba and approved a CIA plan for destructive operations against an oil refinery, storage facilities, an electric plant, sugar refineries, railway bridges, and harbor facilities, and underwater demolition of docks and ships. In fact, Kennedy's last public words of, in Kennedy's last public words about Latin America in Miami on November 18th, JFK emphasized the need to aid the region against Castro and said that my own country is prepared to do this. He urged states throughout the hemisphere to use, quote, every resource at our command to prevent the establishment of another Cuba in this hemisphere, end quote. The idea that JFK was so alarmed by the missiles of 1962 that he had become a man of peace is preposterous. And America's war on Cuba that had been waging violently beginning in 1898 had not slowed at all. The U.S. attempt to oust Castro had not ended, and both the U.S. and Cuba were aware that the acrimony, interference, and subversion was continuing. Indeed, on the day Kennedy was shot in Dallas, a Cuban asset close to Castro, codenamed A.M. Lash, was in Paris receiving a poison pen from a CIA officer in a ham-handed effort to have Castro killed.
You know, usually Scott and I have a lot of fun on these and we do for anime jokes, but we're pretty serious today because this is not a pleasant story to tell, but it's one I think that's really essential because you don't hear it very often because of the kind of Kennedy euphoria and the Kennedy canonization. So thanks as always for listening and supporting the Green Red Podcast. Now to kind of just finish things off, Kennedy had come into life as a political cold warrior, an interventionist, and an imperialist, and nothing changed after the near cataclysms of October 1962. 30 years later, 30 years after the missile crisis, Robert McNamara traveled to Cuba to discuss the events of that time with Castro and others. The defense secretary, who was hawkish during his time in the Pentagon, seemed chastened by the enormity of the missile crisis all those years later. Yet he still believed, as he said in a quote, in a sense, we won. We got the missiles out without a war. My deputy and I brought the five chiefs over, and we sat down with Kennedy. And he said, gentlemen, we won. I don't want you to ever say it, but you know we won. I know we won. And remember that Kennedy, at the initial meeting where the U-2 photos were shown to him on October 16th, was to be said, well, we don't care. From the very outset, Kennedy knew, JFK knew, that those missiles in Cuba, though symbolically powerful, did not threaten the U.S. and did nothing to shift any balance of power between the U.S. and Russia, even minimally. Surely there were officials in the ex-con meetings and in the Pentagon who wanted an immediate military retaliation after the discovery of the missiles in Cuba. The fact that JFK did not go that far, however, is not a fair basis for praise. As the president himself seemed to realize later, that the SS4s were not the danger he was publicly making them out to be. But during the so-called 13 days, Kennedy took a hard line, confronted and challenged Khrushchev. He established a huge quarantine blockade. He provoked confrontations at sea and struck a Soviet sub. And he was reluctant to accept Russia's deal of removing missiles in Cuba and Turkey, and only did so secretly, and we now know engaged in a cover-up to make sure that word of that quid pro quo never got out. In the historical legacy of the missile crisis, Kennedy's fans, and there are many, as we here at the Green and Red podcast know, do not include in the context of their analysis that long, very long record of aggression against Cuba, especially from the Bay of Pigs onward, and the constant Soviet insistence that the missiles were sent to defend Castro's government from a U.S. invasion, which even McNamara himself conceded after the fact. They don't account for the undeniable fact that the U.S. had immense and overwhelming military strength compared to Cuba, obviously, but to the USSR too. Any first strike from either would have been met with annihilation, and all parties involved knew that. Only the U.S., remember, had conducted aggressive operations, most notably in April 1961, but persistently thereafter with its subversive operations, not to mention the most intense embargo in world history. And perhaps most importantly, almost no one discusses the continued aggression after the missile crisis. It's been mostly written out of record. While his supporters and apologists argue that JFK had seen and been terrified by the prospect of a nuclear exchange and had been perilously close to war, the fact is that the president didn't change his stripes. The subversion continued, and the U.S. never, and still doesn't, accept the reality of Castro's governments and spent decades trying to overthrow it, and continues to do this to this day to oust its successors. If JFK's conduct during the missile crisis, giving priority to credibility over peace, aggressive provocations, using military power, and insisting on winning the political battle at the risk of a war that would kill millions, countless millions. If that's seen as a blueprint for how to handle crises, then surely it's inevitable that another such encounter, possibly in the near future, will not end without mushroom clouds. So thank you for listening to a serious episode of the Green and Red podcast, one that is of great historical consequence.
And if you like what you're hearing, please follow us on Facebook or on Instagram, or support us at greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast. We'll talk to you again.
Let's say goodbye with a smile, dear, just for a while, dear, we must part. Don't let this parting upset you, I'll not forget you, sweetheart. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling. like you always do. Till the blue skies chase those dark clouds far away. And I will just say hello to the folks that you know. Tell them you won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as I saw you go, you were singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. To the folks that you know, tell them you won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as I saw you go, you were singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sun.